Support for Soundwaves from the Underground is brought to you by 24tix.com, the most convenient way to buy tickets to your favorite local concerts. Save time, save money, rock out. 24tix.com, your ticket to the experience.
I'm going to do the thing and the drinking and the smoking and the broadcasting. Just one time in my life. Just one time. And you say no. Fuck that. Fuck it.
I'm JP, and this is another edition of Soundwaves from the Underground, the official podcast of Slug Magazine in Salt Lake City, Utah. Slug, an acronym for Salt Lake Underground, is one of the oldest independent publications in the U.S., distributing free monthly issues about music, art, action sports, and subculture. On this week's episode, Jess Smart Smiley, Hive Theaters, Who Are You?, and Ati. Jess Smart Smiley is an illustrator and designer from Provo who graduated from UVU with a degree in design. He then became a freelance artist for small companies and local projects while also creating his own zines and sketchbooks. Smiley's work has been featured on Conan O'Brien's website, TeamCoco.com. When he created a drawing for the late night host, and in October, Smiley will release his first children's book, Upside Down, A Vampire Tale, about the adventures of a vampire who loses his teeth. Slug contributing editor Ricky Vigil recently spoke with Smiley about his artwork and the brand new book.
How did you first get interested in comics?
I think I was just born interested, you know. As a kid, Dad had a pretty extensive comics collection, you know, so I'd go to the library and get books, but, you know, anytime I came home, there were always comics, and I loved X-Men and Ninja Turtles, the old Eastman and Laird original Ninja Turtles, and Spider-Man, of course, Batman. I just ate it up. I loved it as a kid.
So what is it about the medium that interests you? I mean, you just mentioned a bunch of, like, superhero kind of comics, but your stuff is much more indie, alternative style. But what is it about the medium that really draws you to comics?
As far as reading comics goes, like being a reader of comics, I like looking at drawings, for one. And I like seeing, you know, the way a character is drawn over, you know, a period of time and how they communicate things visually. But also, there are a lot of stories that I just love that, you know, I could only get that experience from a comic. A movie, like, would spell it out too much, you know, like I would see too much and I would experience too much, and it doesn't allow me to use my imagination to kind of connect the dots between panels. And I love that about comics. I just love the pacing and kind of the tones you can, you know. And then also with making comics, I love drawing, and I love being able to draw the same guy, you know, 300 times, you know, in different, you know, close-ups, and, you know, looking at them from behind. And it's also a fun way to tell stories, because then I get to share enough of the story without, you know, again, spelling it out for the reader and almost ruining it. You know, I love that there's just enough missing that your mind kind of contributes and builds a unique story. So even though you read and look at the same comic, you know, you might have a different view of what the story actually is.
So when did you start making your own comics?
Probably when I was 8 or so. I made some really goofy comics. And when I was 14 or 15, and just really realizing, this is what I want to do. I want to tell stories. I want to draw pictures. Comics is definitely a big part of that. And I started making some joke comics. They were gag comics, but they had longer stories, so it'd be like a 20-page goofy comic, and I've just been making them ever since.
Tell us a little bit about the basic premise behind Upside Down for our listeners who might not know about it.
Upside Down is about a little boy vampire. His name is Harold. He's a friendly vampire, and he doesn't look like most of the vampires we know. He looks friendly. He's just a little boy, and he loves candy. And in fact, he loves candy so much that he ends up losing his teeth, so now he's this toothless vampire, and he ends up meeting up with this lady named Vermilion, and Vermilion is the last witch on Earth, and so she's kind of hungry and desperate even to keep witchcraft alive, and you know, obviously herself, and she just happens to hate vampires, so they kind of cross paths, and this is their story.
You talked about that you made some kind of longer comics, but is this the longest one that you've ever made?
Yeah, it's the longest one I've ever finished, and you know, before that, the comics I was finishing were 20 or 30 pages long, and I really wanted to get them published at the time and send them out to people, and I'm so glad that I didn't, because they're terrible. I would just feel awful knowing that those are out in the world somewhere, but they're not.
So what was it like going from those shorter comics, and even like, I have your comics grab bag, it has a bunch of your shorter comics, but yeah. What's it like going from those to this big, long, graphic novel-sized comic? What was the creative process? How did it differ?
It was actually really liberating, you know, thinking about it now, like just having the mindset of going from short comics to a full-on, you know, 150-page book, like, it just sounds exhausting. But it was liberating, because when I come up with an idea, it's kind of hard for me to stop coming up with ideas that go along with it and taking it further and building more characters and building a world. And I like thinking that way, and it comes pretty naturally, and I try to encourage that. I made the book in 2010, so it was a couple years ago is when I finished it. And I had started so many graphic novels because I'd been making these shorter comics because I could finish them, but I realized, you know, I have bigger stories to tell, and I really just want to commit to something. And you know, no one's going to publish a 20-page story. Like, it's not long enough to be a book, but it's too long to be a short comic, and it's just this in-between thing that no one knows what to do with. And I really had longer stories to tell. So my one goal for the year 2010 was to finish whatever. You know, I was going to pick one of my graphic novel ideas, and I was just going to finish it, no matter what it took, because I didn't want to live my life, like, not knowing what if I hadn't gone all the way. And I really made it a goal that I was just going to finish and not work on anything else till I'd completed it. And then, you know, I'd have something to send out, and we'd see what, you know, we'll see what happens at least. And so it was really liberating to be able to take these characters further than just, you know, a 20-page, you know, topical story, and it's not like a real in-depth story, but there's kind of a lot going on and some subplots. It was just a lot of fun, really, and now I'm kind of hooked. Now I just want to keep making books, but it's also still nice to go back to some shorter comics and just make, like, little adventures or little situations. That's fun, too.
And I mentioned earlier that I have that comics grab bag. I just always think it's cool when I see local people setting up rad Kickstarters, especially, like, I love comics, so I saw that and I was immediately drawn to it. I was just curious about why you decided to fund that via Kickstarter and what the process was funding that.
I decided to go with Kickstarter on that just because, well, most of the comics had been published in different magazines and websites and books. Sometimes I feel like it's a lot to expect from people that, you know, that follow my work to buy, like, a whole book or a whole magazine just because, you know, they know that I have a comic in it. Like, I don't expect anyone to do that. So I thought it'd be fun to do a collection, and Top Shelf is doing a lot more of their publications digitally, which is awesome, and this is something I just wanted to print, and it's more of like an anthology, you know, and my first book hasn't even come out from Top Shelf yet. And I just didn't want to jinx my relationship with him.
Yeah.
So I was like, you know, I'm going to do this myself, and that way if people like it, then, you know, it'll fund, and if people aren't into it, that's going to be a strong message to me and kind of make me think twice about, you know, how I'm going going about things, but it worked out, and there was a flood of support, and people really liked that, so that was a really fun experience.
Yeah, right. And then I saw on your Facebook or on your website that you're planning a little book tour in support of Upside Down. I just wanted to know a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I do too. I mean, I'm still figuring it out. But basically, I mean, yeah, I just want to do a tour. I've been doing presentations at schools and libraries and bookstores about drawing and making comics and telling stories and how to turn ideas into a book, you know? And I love that. And now that I have this book to share, I genuinely, I mean, I'm not into selling products, you know? I would not draw. I would go work in a sales company for something. I don't want to sell anything. I really want to make these comics, and I really want to share them with people. And I figure, what better way to have a physical copy of the book and to go out to stores, go out to schools, go out to libraries, and you know, talk about it and have little presentations and get to meet, you know, some of the people that are reading it. I think it's a great opportunity for me, you know. I'm starting to schedule some, like APE, the Alternative Press Expo.
Oh, yeah.
Is going on in the middle of October. I plan on going there, and I've been talking with bookstores that are there in or around San Francisco and places along the way too, and from California, from Utah, you know, that I can stop. And a lot of people have been, you know, like just emailing me, hey, if you need a place to stay, come talk with me. Hey, if you want to share a table, I'll take care of it. I mean, people are really getting behind it, and it's really cool.
Yeah, that's rad. Do you have anything scheduled in Salt Lake or anywhere else, like in the Valley?
I don't have anything scheduled yet in Utah, and it's mainly because I know, oh gosh, like there's so many places I want to visit in, you know, Salt Lake and Provo and just all over. But, you know, I don't really know California. Since I know I'm going out for APE, I'm going to kind of plan that out. And Salt Lake also, I feel like I have a little more time, you know, I could, you know, over like 3 months, you know, visit a few places. Still working out, but I am talking with different stores and libraries. So if you know anyone that, you know, is up for it, let me know.
Yeah, okay, yeah, I'll definitely keep my ear to the ground.
Upside Down, A Vampire Tale is currently on sale for just $9.95 through Top Shelf Productions. You can purchase a copy at Top Shelf Comics, that's comics with an X.com. For more information on Smart, his artwork, and other collections, visit him online at jess-smiley.com. Joshua James is an Americana folk musician based out of American Fork who started releasing music back in 2006. He gained national exposure when songs from his third album, The Sun Is Always Brighter, started receiving airplay on NPR, and then he was voted Best 2007 Folk Album on iTunes, so he definitely started building up speed around there, and his fourth album, 2009's Build Me This, received even more exposure on the FX show Sons of Anarchy. And most notably, recently he appeared at South by Southwest, Exponential Fork Fest, and Bonnaroo, along with touring with John Mayer, Andy DeFranco, and Brent Denon. This November, James will release his fifth full-length album, From the Top of Willamette Mountain. Here's Joshua James with Sister from his fifth full-length album.
So long, be careful on your way back home. I found your suicide poem in your right coat pocket. There was a fire in the Hollywood Hills. 10 children were killed. You had better be cautious. I'll pray for your sister wherever your heart is. Take comfort in the fact you're young. You've got 10 years to grow up. Don't become like your father. I'm sure you know by now the rain falls most along the California coast. Each time this season I hate for your anger to turn into something like mine. Stay close to water, the air helps the motion inside, inside. But deep down, bless your soul, you're a child, I'll never know just why.
Sister from Joshua James and the album From the Top of Willamette Mountain. That will be released on November 5th. James will start a United Kingdom tour starting October 18th in Stockton-on-Tees, and that will run until early November. For more information on James and his music, visit him online at joshuajames.tv. The Hype Theater Company launched in the fall of 2010 in Salt Lake City. The company, led by writer-director Jared Greathouse, opened in April of 2011 with the production Wordplay, a compilation of one-act plays from David Ives. This season, the company is stepping away from national works and producing more in-house creations, such as Who Are You?, written by Greathouse, who also serves as the play's lead actor. Slug writer Johnny Logan recently sat down with Greathouse to talk about Hive and the play.
Can you tell us a little bit about the Hive Theater Company and, you know, how you got started?
I started the Hive Theater Company back in August of 2010, a kind of platform for artists as well as art that hasn't really been showcased in Utah, or perhaps people haven't dared showcase. It's kind of risky theater, I guess you'd put it that way.
What plays have you produced in the past few years?
We started with Wordplay, which was kind of a compilation of a bunch of David Ives works, a lot of surreal one acts and stuff like that. We later did Baby with the Bathwater by Christopher Durang, a very interesting comedy. It was a lot of fun. We just got finished with At Home at the Zoo by Edward Albee down in the Sugar Space, and it was pretty successful. We had a good time doing it.
When the chair broke, was that meant to happen, or?
It wasn't, actually. That was, I had been beating the hell out of that bench since rehearsals. We actually repaired it about 4 times. But at that point, the iron actually gave on the bench, and it actually happened at a pretty opportune time. I thought it was right at the climax of the play.
It made for an incredible scene, yeah, I must say.
Everyone came up to me afterwards like, did you guys plan that? That was amazing. And I kind of nodded and just said, yeah, we planned it. But no.
You didn't hurt yourself at all?
No, I barely noticed that it broke, to tell you the truth. Next thing I look up and I'm on the ground looking up and I'm like, what happened? You know, I was just really into the moment, which was nice.
Why did you start the Hive?
I used to do a lot of theater when I was younger, back when I was 18 to probably 21. I like a lot of shows around the valley and stuff like that. And I kind of got jaded, I guess you'd put it. I didn't really find the roles that I was looking for, and I didn't really feel like the plays I was doing really fulfilled me as an artist. So I kind of went back to music, which was my first love. Kind of went back and played for a rock band called Dacho for a while. And eventually it kind of pulled me back in. I think I realized as a musician that I was just trying to tell stories the best I could. Like, I looked at the songs I was writing at the time and they were just stories of what I knew in my life, you know. And I felt like I was kind of limiting myself as far as the stories I could tell just in music, whereas theater will encompass music, dance, movement, acting, technical, you know, lighting, stuff like that, just about every axis of art. I think that's what pulled me back in.
Let's talk a little bit about your guys' latest play, Who Are You?, which you wrote. What can you tell us about this one?
I wrote it a couple of years ago as a one act. I really felt like it had more juice left in it. I felt like it had more of a storyline, so I kind of messed with it a little bit, tweaked with the storyline, and ended up writing somewhat full length. It's a short little play, but about an hour 15, hour 20 minutes. It really is a statement of myself as a writer. I don't really consider myself a writer. I consider myself an actor for the most part, but this is my first produced script. It's kind of about the relationship between an audience and the artist, kind of the communication that goes back and forth, the relationship between the critic and the artist. And as soon as that communication ends, where are you left with your art? You know, like, if you can't communicate anything in your art, is it worth doing at all? I guess that's the point. It bases around two characters, Stephanie and Jerry. Stephanie wakes up one morning and doesn't recognize her husband. Kind of freaks out. He thinks for a moment that she might have amnesia, something like that. So the play kind of progresses as them trying to figure out who exactly this Jerry guy is, or who is impersonating Jerry.
Noticed a recurring theme in some of the Hive shows that I've seen. You know, At Home at the Zoo is a really good example, but kind of, you know, involving the exploration of relationships between characters within each piece, and especially as the audience, you know, not directly interactive, but, you know, there's also that relationship there that kind of gets explored. Is this something that you're going for with pieces that you produce or put on?
Yeah, I think it's a theme that draws me in quite a bit. Communication and relationships between people are such an important part of life, and the theme of the play is who we are as people, what makes us who we are. And I think a big part of who we are is our relationships with each other. I mean, you take a little bit of each person that you meet over your lifetime, and that makes you who you are. I mean, even the smallest person that affected you in the smallest way can sometimes turn out to be a Goliath change in your life.
Where did the idea for this play come from?
It's an interesting story. I actually moved into my house, I think 3 years back, something like that. And I was sitting at my kitchen table, drinking some coffee, and all of a sudden I hear this big boom, and my whole house just shook. I thought it was really odd, so I went to my window to see what was at my door, and all of a sudden I hear another boom, and the whole house just shakes again. And I hear a crash in my back door, so I fling open the pantry door to see what was going on, and there was this guy just standing there staring at me. The weirdest part was I heard this voice that was like, "Who are you?" But it sounded like a demonic Tom Waits, like, just kind of a voice I didn't recognize, but it was actually coming out of my mouth. And I think my adrenaline was going so fast at that point that I was kind of watching myself the whole time. I chased him out my back door, down the street. I was in my pajamas and bare feet. And I think about that guy a lot. I don't know him, but I think he affected my life in a certain way. As I like to think about the connections, and like we were talking about before, just relationships with people that you don't think you know, but in reality, you might know them very well.
What do you think makes this piece important? Why should people come out and see this show particularly?
It's a brand new piece. I think that's something that's very important, especially in the Salt Lake theater scene. You see a lot of new pieces coming out lately. I think there's a few slated for the next year already, just from local playwrights. I think it's a cool thing to see. As far as people getting something from the play, I hope they get something from it. I think if anything else, they'll be entertained. I think it'll be something that they haven't seen before. Yeah, they won't get bored, I can guarantee that.
What is the Hive Theater doing to push theater forward in our community? You know, like, what kind of aesthetics do you employ? Things like that.
As far as what I want to push artistically, like I was saying before, just something new, something bold. And it's a theme I explore a lot in Who Are You? Is being able to express yourself without kind of hindering yourself at the same time. You always have these voices in your head that you can't do this. Like, no one's gonna like this. And I think that holds a lot of artists back. But I think one thing I would like to push with the Hive is to let artists know that if they want to do it, go out and do it. I mean, there's nothing holding you back. Just do a play that you want to do. If you love it enough, you'll find out a way to produce it. You'll find out a way to get it out to the people.
Tour U will run from October 5th through the 6th and 12th through the 13th at the Sugar Space in Sugar House. Tickets are $12 with all plays starting at 7:30. For more info on the company, visit them online at thehivetheater.blogspot.com. It is my great pleasure and honor to announce Mr. Ricky Vigil. He is our contributing editor here at Slug Magazine. He's going to help us on the weekly daily calendar rundown. Thanks for joining me, Ricky.
It is my great privilege and honor to be here. I think that's what he said.
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
I could throw in the scholar and gentleman ship, but that's trite and played out.
Yeah,
so.
I'm at least one of those things.
Good.
Yeah.
And we'll just leave it up to the mystery of which one is which.
Yeah.
I want, first of all, to commend you publicly. I just did off air. About your great selection of events this week. Why don't you start us off on Wednesday, October 3rd? What's going on?
Well, on Wednesday, October 3rd, we have Mike Watt, who is the bassist of the Minutemen. That's what he's most known for. Minutemen, obviously a legendary punk band from San Pedro, California. Mike Watt has been in a bunch of bands. He's been in Firehose, Dose. He even played in the Stooges. This band that he's playing with now is called the Missing Men. Mike Watt comes to town pretty often, probably, I'd say, once a year, somewhere around there. But it's always really cool to have, like, a legendary punk musician come to Salt Lake, and people are always stoked to see Mike Watt. I mean, I would say that a lot of his music sounds pretty similar to when he was in the Minutemen, but, you know, it's still really cool. I've never seen Mike Watt, actually. Maybe I'll make an effort to come see Mr. Mike Watt this time around.
Great, maybe make the effort.
I'll maybe make the effort. I haven't decided, but, you know, maybe I'll make the effort.
It's a solid maybe.
Yeah, solid maybe for sure.
And Thursday, October 4th, what's going on then?
Well, we have St. Vitus and Weed Eater at the Urban Lounge. And St. Vitus, for people who don't know, I mean, I don't know why they wouldn't. They're this legendary doom metal band. They're kind of the same ilk as Black Sabbath. A little later on in terms of time, they came around in the late 1970s. They're around with bands like Pentagram, Candlemass. But anyway, if you like slow, just traditional, heavy metal, you'd probably be into St. Vitus. And they have a really cool new record that came out this year. And the other band that's playing is a band that a lot of people are stoked on called Weed Eater. What do you think most of their metal's about, JP?
I would say probably unicorns, you know. Standard metal stuff?
I would say marijuana.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Difference of opinion?
The one thing that this band, besides making a lot of songs about marijuana, is that their singer, not too long ago, shot off his own toe with a shotgun. And we have an interview on the Slug Mag website where he basically just talks about the experience of shooting off his toe and how he learned how to walk again and how it has affected his bass playing and his stage presence in the time since.
That's a real thing.
Yeah, for real.
Who did the interview?
Briar Wharton, and I think Dylan Chadwick may have helped him with that, but it is a really good interview. It's very entertaining. I highly recommend going to read that interview. St. Vitus, Weed Eater, Ricky Vigil, stamp of approval. And that's at the Urban Lounge, so check that out.
Oh, I forgot. You approve this event.
I do approve this event. I'm Ricky Vigil.
And Friday, one of my favorite Canadian groups is going to be in town at the Depot. Will you give us the rundown on them?
Yeah, so this is Metric. I'm not super familiar with Metric. The main reason I know about Metric is that in the movie Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, the band, the fictional band, the Clash of Demonhead, performs a song, and it's really a Metric song. They pretended that it was a Clash of Demonhead song, but it's a Metric song. That's how I'm aware of them. There's members of Broken Social Scene in this band. They have a really big following, and the Depot, I think, is a pretty cool venue. I think that would be a cool place to see a band like Metric.
Definitely.
Yeah.
I want to go to that show.
I think you should.
Okay, thank you. Do you approve that event?
I approve this event, especially for JP. Yeah, you're welcome.
There's another event, actually, on Friday as well.
Yeah, we got the latest installment of the Rooftop Concert Series in Provo, and that's at the Downtown Parking Terrace at 100 North, 100 West. And these events are actually really, really big in Provo. I was going to say really fucking big, but I didn't know if our Provo listeners would approve of that language. They have big crowds at all these events. They're cool bands, too. I mean, maybe not my scene, but the Lower Lights, Polka Dots. Polka Dots are pretty big in Salt Lake, too. It's like more mellow kind of music. It's music you can take the whole family to and sit on a roof and chill out and have a nice relaxing night in Provo.
How delightful.
Yeah. I bet you could like even sit on a blanket. That's, you know, blankets, rooftops, folk music, Provo.
My favorite place. One of my favorite places.
Me too. I used to go to Orem all the time for Nickel Cade, but that's another story. Anyway.
And Monday, October 8th, one of my favorite named bands in the hard music scene.
Morbid Angel. That is a pretty badass name. I mean, that's everything you need right there.
Yep.
I mean, Morbid Demon, that's, I mean, the juxtaposition of Morbid and Angel, I think, is really good. Right there.
They're really deep. They went deep with that.
Anyway, they're playing at the Complex, and if you follow metal at all, you will have known that people fucking hate the new Morbid Angel album. The new album, it has a bunch of industrial elements. People were not into it. They just don't like this album. People are pissed on the internet. So it should be cool to see if people come out, if they don't come out, if they boo the new songs, if they applaud the new songs. Maybe the internet's lying to all of us. But anyway, they're also playing with Grave.
And where can people find out more calendar information?
There are a few places, JP. You can go to slugmag.com. We have the daily calendar listed there. You can flip to the back of every issue of Slug. And you could look at the Slug iPhone app. And if you have any events that you want to see listed in the daily calendar, just email them to dailycalendar@slugmag.com, and we will get them in all of those wondrous places that you can read the daily calendar.
And if your event's exciting enough, we will talk about it in our weekly roundup.
Definitely.
Hey, thanks for joining me again, Ricky.
Thanks for having me, JP.
Book on Tapeworm is a melodic acoustic band from Provo that has released singles and music videos over the past 2 years, and will soon be releasing their debut album, All the World's a Stage, this month. Here's Corners off their debut full-length album, All the World's a Stage.
Is he as lonesome as he looks? And will I end up the same? Alone in a room full of books with no picture frames. I'm not photogenic, but I'll take your pictures, love. You'll see that I'll be the finger in the corner of your favorite memories. I see the old man see. His face looks quite like mine. I lack the courage to wait. And my future self just a few years closer to the grave. Stories, and I'll be the voice in the corner singing you to sleep. The old man walks through a side door. Stairs to an office and opens a drawer where he keeps the files and fills out a form and writes in the space. I don't recognize myself anymore. And the photographs will show. Growing old is the slowest form of time travel. It's the slowest form of time travel. Growing old is the slowest form of time travel. It's the slowest form of time travel.
low. I'm as lonesome as I loved.
That was Book on Tapeworm with Corners from their debut full-length album, All the World's a Stage. They'll be releasing on October 13th at Velour. The show will be starting at 8, and it's just $6. For more info on the group, visit them online at bookontapeworm.com. Auti is a short film created by Derek Gainsforth, centered around autism. The film focuses on families in Utah who have children with autism and the struggles they go through as local insurance companies refuse to cover that condition under their medical plans. Utah is currently one of 18 states left who have not issued mandates to companies requiring them to cover autism. Slug writer Ben Trentleman interviewed Gainsforth about the film.
This is a pretty compelling film about your family. How have you been affected by autism, and what drove you to make the film?
Our oldest son, who's 6 years old now, was diagnosed with autism when he was 2.5. And after the diagnosis, the diagnosis was already, you know, enough to handle, which most families would be really horribly devastated by it, which we really weren't, you know, because, you know, we saw, like, the writing on the walls with him, you know, and how he kind of, you know, was developing and going. When he was diagnosed, it was just kind of like, you know, it was just kind of affirming that, you know, for us. So, you know, we were like, okay, great, now he can get the services that he needs, now we can, you know, get him into the therapies that he needs, and speech therapies, and occupational therapies, and, you know, we thought it was great that he finally had that diagnosis to further those things. But what happened was we got denied our insurance claims. And it's like, oh, he goes to a physical therapist and, oh, he gets denied. He goes to a speech therapist, he gets denied. That's like $500-$600 a pop just for one visit. It's ridiculous. You know, so then you go further trying to figure out what's wrong with him, and he's getting denied for things like getting spinal taps done, EEGs, right?
Sleep studies.
Get denied by the insurance company. Why? Because one word, autism. That one word is put on those papers and they deny the claim. You know, we have families that are getting denied claims because of, like, well child visits. You know, they'll go in for, really? You know, like, really? Your typical kid can go in and get these services, but my kid who has autism, you know, because of that one word, what, you know? So basically it's like, what is it about that word, autism, you know, first, that makes insurance companies not want to cover it, and second, like, what are we going to do to change that? Initially, when we started the documentary project, it was about neurodiversity, right, which is the idea that we're all different, that we all have different minds, and that we all think differently. So initially, yeah, we kicked the project off, and we really just wanted to showcase how kids with autism were they were different, but they weren't less, you know, that they were different, but they had a lot to contribute to society, you know. But as we went on, you know, in the process of filming and in the process of getting denied visits from insurance companies and losing our house and filing bankruptcy because of this diagnosis, we kind of turned the volume up a little bit more on what the cause actually was, you know. So the message is neurodiversity. The cause is equality, really. Equal rights for people with autism.
Here in this state, what are they doing? Why isn't the state doing more?
Why isn't the state doing more is an interesting question. We have some great services for autism in that we have, like, we have certain, like, grants for special schools that these kids can go to that are sort of governed a little bit. So we have those resources available, but we don't think that a medical, I don't want to say condition. I guess that would, for lack of a better word, a medical condition should be left up to the school system to treat, you know?
Like, yeah.
It's the only medical diagnosis left up to the school system to treat, you know? So what we wanted to do, particularly the Utah Autism Coalition, which is fighting for the rights, or fighting for insurance reform for these kids. And so what they did was put together a bill in conjunction with Autism Speaks, which is the nation's largest organization for autism, and put this bill together, which was House Bill 69, last year in 2012 legislative session. And they tried to push it through to, and basically, I can't tell you exactly verbatim what it said, but it was basically covering occupational therapy, speech therapy, and basic medical. So so it was a mandate to put that, you know, on the insurance companies to cover autism, basically. But what ended up happening was, I mean, there was a big fight. We fought hard as Utah autism community, fought hard to get that bill passed, and it got shot down. I can't really go into the details of, you know, why it got shot down. I don't want to speak for the state, and I really don't want to make this about, like, a right versus left issue. Mm-hmm. In many ways, personally, my personal opinion is that I feel it's somewhat, you know, attributed to that. I can't say that that's exactly what it is, but I really can't honestly really answer why the state hasn't taken a bigger initiative.
Our state has the largest autism population right now, too. The numbers just keep climbing, and with it being such a family-oriented state, you would think they would do more to mm-hmm. help these kids, because there are more kids in Utah being diagnosed with autism than any other state. And I don't know why, but they're just not doing what they should to help us.
So with this, is there any, what is the reasoning behind insurance companies not covering treatment for autism in the first place?
Well, there's a lot of ideas, you know, like, first, there's no cure for autism, and that's, you know, really the cause is under a lot of controversy, you know, has a lot of controversy surrounding it. Years ago, you heard a lot about vaccines, and it was like, oh, vaccines cause autism, and they did a lot. CDC has disproven that, so my understanding is that autism is not caused by vaccines. I do think that, you know, there are some kids that have maybe gotten the shot, and their immune system was compromised a little bit. I don't think that the shot was the cause of the autism. My personal opinion is that autism is genetic, and that autism is dormant in those people. You know, there are a lot of people over the years, especially, like, I mean, because since autism has risen over the last 20 years, like, to be so prominent, my opinion is that those people were already there. We just didn't notice them as autistic because we didn't really know what autism was, you know? Like, the DSM, which is the journal that talks about medical disorders and kind of defines what is a mental disorder. The definition of autism has changed. It's broadened and it's loosened. And so with that, you have, like, high-functioning autism and low-functioning autism. Autism doesn't have to be some kid that's putting holes in walls and can't speak, and which they would be.
Yeah.
But it also can be, like, that kid that can do amazing math in his head, and, you know, he's really socially awkward. That kid's autism, too.
Lifetime costs due to it are, like, $3.5 million for lifetime costs for a child with autism. So that might be another reason why insurances don't want to step in, because they know how much it's going to cost. But you're going to pay that much money for a kid that has cancer or Down syndrome, and they aren't classified in that. So
yeah, and so it's just the definition is too broad.
I don't think anyone knows why, because when you would call in, like when I would personally call in and say, why did you deny my claim? They'd say, well, your child has autism. And I'd say, well, why deny the claim? You're just telling me what I already know. And they would just say, well, I'm sorry. We're just told that is classified under a number that we cannot take care of. And they never go delve into it. It's just kind of like, this is how I'm going to tell you. Wow. They have autism. We can't help you.
I mean, with that being said, what do you feel is kind of the overall perception of autism? How do people react when you say that your child has autism?
Oh, when we say, Corbin has autism, mm-hmm. the first thing I think the majority would say something like, "Oh, I'm so sorry," you know, yeah, like, or, "Oh,
don't, I couldn't tell."
Oh, I couldn't tell. Or, "Oh, man, how do you do it?"
Yeah,
you know,
or, "I'm sorry."
Yeah, and there's actually there's a list on our friend who's in the film, Christine Passy, the vice president of the Utah Autism Coalition. She has a website called Autism Island, and on it she has this list of 50 things you don't say to autism parents. Yeah. You know,
and
those are most
it's so true.
Most of them are exactly what people will say at first.
Our son bites, and a couple years ago we were at a Costco, I think, and he was biting Derek's like part of his finger in between his hand, and he won't let go. So the only thing you can do is really just kind of smack his cheek to make him let go. And some lady was just staring at him like he was beating him to death, and he was like, "Do you want him to draw blood?" You know, and that's what you get. And a lot of parents, like, we had a guy at a buffet one time, and he just comes up to us and he's like, "Can you get your kid away from me?" And I'm almost like,
because he's wandering and he's curious.
And I said, "I'm sorry, my child has autism," and you know, he was coughing at the time. I said, "He's not sick, he just doesn't know how to cover his mouth when he coughs." And he says, "Well, can you get him away from me? I don't want him over here. Why do they let people like him in here?"
Why do they let people like that in here?
I mean, he wasn't doing anything wrong. He was just a little close to his table, and I'm just, you know, people just don't think before they say things.
People, when you have a kid with autism, I mean, you learn to hate people.
And
people are dicks.
They get hurt,
you know?
Too. I mean, Corbin's come up to me a couple times crying, saying, you know, people have been mean to me, or, you know, that person said something to me, and they know what you're saying.
Yeah.
So when you think they're stupid, they're not stupid. They know exactly what you're saying. You're not being nice to them, and they know it.
They get it. Yeah, they know when you're being sincere. They're in there. They're totally in there. That's my biggest thing too, like bringing that out. And what we want to showcase is that people with autism are amazing.
Yes.
You know that they thought that Einstein had autism. You know, they thought like there are so many people that
I mean, look at Temple Grandin.
Temple Grandin.
A good, you know, example for you. I mean, she's huge now. She, you know, revolutionized the agriculture world, you know, and she's huge, but she has autism. But she, you know, knows how to use what her gifts are.
And we believe that you can't change the world without thinking differently. You have to be able to think differently, you know, and we think, like I always tell everybody, I say, I work so hard at being different and getting tattoos and, you know, being part of this whole different thing. But I look at Corbin and I envy him because he was born different, you know?
Yeah.
Like, we were all born different. But when I look at Corbin, like, Corbin was born different.
Yeah.
And that to me is something that should be admired, not shunned upon. Don't shun my autistic kid. Don't shun me because I have a kid with autism. And if anything,
don't pity
watch
us
out.
Either. Yeah, pitying us is another thing that people do. And you don't need to pity me. Mm-hmm. I have fun on my own with my child, you know?
Like, oh, you lost your house because of autism? Oh, well.
Yeah, well, guess what? I didn't have to pay a mortgage that I couldn't pay for, so I'm good with that, you know?
I might
rent a house, but at least I rent a house and I'm home with my kids, you know, and I like it a lot more. So
the things that autism has taken away from our family are a drop in the bucket compared to what Corbin has done for the family.
Yeah,
you know,
definitely.
You bring him around anybody, and everybody knows Corbin. Corbin is a star. He's a superstar, you know. And I'm grateful that Corbin is able to just by being him change the world. You know, I mean, he's changing people's worlds just by being his six-year-old little self.
Yeah, every time we go to our local pizza place, they know it's Corbin, and they get all excited. And
everybody knows Corbin.
People know Corbin.
But the whole thing is, like, it's not about being a local celebrity, you know? In many ways, it's more just about showcasing people who are different are the ones changing the world. People who are different are the ones who are going to make the difference.
Yeah.
When I look at, like, Temple Grandin has a great quote, which is one of my favorite quotes, and I'm totally paraphrasing, but she said, "We need to take these kids out of institutions and put them in Silicon Valley where they belong." Right? You know?
Yeah.
So that's kind of our focus, like, and our goal and our mission is, one, if insurance companies could see that, and when we could get these kids treatments and help. Not help. I don't want to say help like they're being cured. I'm talking about...
Like physical therapy and...
Yeah, we know, want...
Stuff
we,
like that.
We want to tone down the things that are frustrating them or whatever, yeah. But we want to bring out the things that autism really, you know. So we're really big on, like, not using the word cure or cause.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I think a lot of people focus so much with autism on cures and causes. But what they really need to focus on is, like, their kids.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, your kid is who he is. So look at the things that are wrong, that are hindering him. Like Corbin has seizures. Okay, he needs to take some seizure medication or figure this out.
Or he, you know, he'll smack his head into walls until he gets welts. He has to take behavioral medication for that, or he will hurt someone else or himself. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that has to happen. He takes swim therapy because it helps straighten his legs out because he wobbles when he walks. So that's going to help him too.
So you take...
We don't do anything to, like, make him different.
So you take those things that are hindering him and you focus on them and you give them the therapy they need.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But that amazing mind he has to get 3 million stars on Angry Birds, you know, all of that stuff that he's able to construct a perfectly amazing architectural masterpiece with magnet blocks, you know, that's going to change the world. That's, there you go. He's already got his talents. He's already got what he needs.
The film will be debuting on October 4th at the Whitmore Library at 7 p.m. For more information on the film and its premiere, visit them online at auti.org. That's AUTIE.org. Thanks for listening to another edition of Sound Waves from the Underground. For all things Slug Magazine, visit slugmag.com. As you guys know, Jeffrey Stedman of Yelp is a big fan of pizza. So much so that we've decided to do a show dedicated to his favorite kind of pie. What are some of your favorite places in town to get pizza? Let us know and we will pass that information along to Jeffrey. And we can talk about it on our upcoming Yelp segments. You can either send an email to soundwaves@slugmag.com or call and leave us a message on our automated voicemail line at 858-233-9324. We may just play you on the show. This podcast was created by Slug Magazine and is produced by Gavin Sheehan with associate producers Esther Moronio, Ricky Vigil, Alexander Ortega, and JP. Our executive producer is Angela H. Brown. Our theme was performed by Birthquake and recorded by Jesse Ellis. Our main logo and art design is by T-Dong, with technical design by Kate O'Connor. On next week's show, the influential and infamous Salt Lake group Iceburn, the aforementioned Yelp pizza segment, and Theta Knot.